So today we're going to continue our series on the Bill of Rights. This is the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Last week, or last episode, we talked about the First Amendment, which included religion, speech, press, right to assemble. This week, the amendment we're talking about is a little more focused. And that's good because this is a pretty contentious issue. So join us today on An Incomplete History while we take a deep dive into the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. That's the one about guns. Hello and welcome to An Incomplete History.
I'm Hillary.
And I'm Jeff.
We're your hosts for this weekly history podcast.
So, Hillary, we're drying out here.
Congratulations. I heard you got a deluge.
We had a rainy Thanksgiving. Wow, it was rainy. Like crazy rainy. Like rainy for anywhere in the country.
That's what I heard. And you guys are still alive and doing okay. And I'm very proud of you because I know it can shut down the whole city. So we moved out here in August and I thought our backyard, oh my gosh, it's so beautiful. It's like a jungle out here. It's so shaded. It's so beautiful. And I counted 12 different trees on the property. And I have to say that there's a lot of leaves. A lot of leaves fall off of 12 trees. Like,
yeah.
We are buried in leaves out here. And we've been like raking, and nothing seems to happen. It doesn't even look like we did anything, but that's the situation. Like, I guess it's kind of weather related out here, but we're just absolutely buried in leaves.
So today's the Second Amendment. Some people have very strong opinions on this.
I think most people have very strong opinions.
Do you? Because I kind of was informally talking to some colleagues and students and things about it. And a lot of them just didn't really have a strong opinion one way or the other. But when I found somebody who had an opinion, if you had an opinion, it tended to be a strong opinion.
Okay, that's fair. Because I did some.
So I would say either you don't really care or you really care one way or the other. And there doesn't seem to be much in between, which is interesting. But just to catch people up, the Second Amendment has to do with the right to bear arms. And let me just kind of read really quickly the language from the Constitution.
I want to read it too, because we have to read it multiple times because it's a horrible sentence that makes no sense. But you do the first reading.
Well, why don't you read it? Why don't you read it first?
Okay. So it says, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
There's a comma after state.
What a stupid sentence. What a stupid sentence.
But there's a comma after state.
Okay. I had a pause.
I don't know whether that helps.
You don't read comma out. You don't say comma, the right of the people.
Well, I mean, I did when I read that last week, remember?
But the sentence makes no sense.
Well, does the comma help clarify it?
Not to me, no. I mean, so let's read the first part of it makes sense.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. And you would expect it to say is something, something, something.
Right, but it does not.
But instead it says the right of
period, right?
Right. A well-regulated militia is necessary.
We're on the same page.
The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
They're two separate thoughts, and they mean the exact opposite thing, in my opinion.
Maybe. I mean, let's travel back to England, back to the Glorious Revolution.
Okay, yeah, that's where I wanted to start. Very good.
Yeah, let's talk about the Glorious Revolution and this. The Bill of Rights is kind of reimagined in England in 1689 and what that says. Because I think this will give us a little bit of clarity. And I know people are like, well, no, just talk about America. And it's like, well, you know, but you've got to understand the background because The Bill of Rights, as we talked about last episode, it's not coming out in a vacuum. A lot of it is responses to stuff that happened in England. But I think for the Second Amendment particularly, it's not just stuff happening in England. It is colonial Americans' particular engagement with events in the colonies combined, right? I think it's multiple things functioning here. It's their location on the periphery of an empire in a place that's not all that secure, at least in their minds, combined with ideas that come about during the Glorious Revolution.
Yeah, so they basically copied a lot of the rights that come out of the English Bill of Rights, and one of them is the right to bear arms. And the right, though, stems out of the Glorious Revolution, but also just stems from the tyrannical powers of Europe during that era. And so as a reaction to this outright tyranny, is what they would say, people wanted to have the right to be able to defend themselves against their own government. And this becomes salient when you really think of specific examples. So one of the examples that comes up again and again when you're thinking about Europe during the 17th century and the need of people to have maybe weapons in their own homes to defend themselves is the French Huguenots, right?
Right.
They're a really good example because you have this group of people who are persecuted in France. They're Protestants in France in the late 1680s. Soldiers would invade these Protestant homes. They would steal from the inhabitants. They would terrorize them, torture them until they either converted to Catholicism or left the country. So these people, these French Huguenots, many of them found refuge in America because we talk about religious persecution a lot and we talk about the Puritans, we talk about people coming from England. But this other group of people who is fleeing a tyrannical government are Protestants who were fleeing the Catholic regimes in France and coming over to America and trying to get away from this tyranny. And this also relates to the Third Amendment, which we'll talk about at some point, I'm sure, but about the quartering of soldiers. Of soldiers are just allowed to come into people's houses, steal whatever they wanted, terrorize families. And so the idea of keeping and bearing arms in your home to protect yourself and your family stems from a very real threat. And that's something to think about every time you consider, well, why were these amendments brought to the fore? Like, why were these even important? I mean, you think about, this is the second thing that they say that people can do. And it's because it's in response to a legitimate threat.
Right. Well, let's talk about what the Bill of Rights in 1689, so this is the English Bill of Rights, what it actually says. So it talks about James II. So here you have a Catholic king over a Protestant nation. There are still Catholic English as well, but there was, you know, the text that they put in to the English Bill of Rights, whereas the late King James II, by the assistance of diverse evil counselors, judges, and ministers employed by him, did endeavor to subvert and extirpate the Protestant religion and the laws and liberties of this kingdom, spelled with an E, by causing several good subjects being Protestants to be disarmed at the same time when Papists, so those are Roman Catholics, were both armed and employed contrary to law. And it ends, this whole section kind of ends with it saying that the subjects which are Protestants may have arms for their defense suitable to conditions and is allowed by law. So I mean, legal scholars who've looked at this have said, what this does is say Parliament and the king cannot take away your right to have guns to protect yourself, kind of, right? It's very muddy, right? I mean, this whole thing about arms must be as allowed by a law. I mean, what does that mean, allowed by law?
Well, this language, even though muddy, it does have these roots in the 17th century, but that language has continued to be used and was actually used and cited in a Supreme Court case all the way in 2008.
Yep. So we're going to talk about that, right? Yeah. This is the thing. So justices on the Supreme Court, they are much smarter than we are about kind of legal precedent. And they go back and they kind of look at this and they consider it important to figure out what influenced the Second Amendment's creation. And to say, okay, if the authors of the Second Amendment are drawing on the English Bill of Rights, we need to go back and look what that says. Does this maybe help clarify what's being said at all? It kind of does, because it gives us a situation where you've got a sovereign who's taking guns away from a group of people, but allowing another group of people who he supports to have guns. Right?
Right. So, yeah, trying to draw off of that language ends up being important. But like you said, the language itself is difficult to get to the bottom of. And then the language of the amendment as it's written is also difficult, because to me, as I said earlier, is like the statements kind of contradict each other. So there isn't, you can interpret it either way. And I think that the Supreme Court decisions in the 21st century have kind of strengthened the Second Amendment, but on what basis? I mean, they're going back to the language of the 17th century, but to me, it seems unclear still.
Right. Well, I mean, and then some legal historians and legal scholars have actually argued, look, this isn't meant to even address your ability to own a small firearm in your home, that's something that just kind of is accepted. That this has to do with kind of militia and the militia's role. But to kind of get at that, we need to talk about the particular situation for English settlers in North America and kind of what their lives were like prior to the Constitution. So,
well, yeah, revolutionary America. Go ahead.
Right. So if you're like, if you are an English settler in Massachusetts, particularly prior to like the King Philip's war and conflicts like that, first of all, you imagine you're surrounded by hostile indigenous peoples. A lot of times that hostility is a result of things you've done. Beyond that, to the north, you have the French, who are Catholic. Now, remember, if you're in Massachusetts, you're Protestant at this point. And then, you know, far to the south, you've got the Spanish, who are also Catholic. So you probably think you are constantly under assault, right? Or you constantly are under threat of invasion.
And they probably perceived it that way, yeah. But I mean, I think the more important point there is that there's no standing army.
Right. Then there's no standing army. There's no police you can go to. So whose job is it when something happens? Oh, we just had this weird boat sail up. What are we supposed to do? Well, there's no police force, there's no army to kind of deal with it. So it's left up to the individual people. So the militia is responsible. And this is, you know, militias have been a thing back in England, so this isn't anything new. But they really are just kind of left to their own devices. So if you have to rely on a militia, it's important everybody has a gun. Right?
Right,
and that everybody be willing to be called to help if necessary. So if you've got that, but then even after independence, the original Articles of Confederation, again, they actually prohibit the federal government from creating a standing army. Right?
Correct.
So this is, everybody still needs to have guns, because you've still got to have a militia that can be called up if a situation arises where that might be necessary.
Well, consider too that because there's no standing army, because there's no, of course, during the revolution, there's really no country, so to speak. It's an open rebellion. And a country is attempting to be formed, but because there's no real country and no, you know, nothing laid out yet, It's not like you say, okay, Army, everybody get together, everybody line up. Here's your issued gun from the federal government, right? We bought you all these brand new guns. We bought you these flak jackets. We bought you these flashlights, or, you know, all the things that people get now. And of course, some of those things didn't exist. But like, when you join the military now, I mean, you get some swag, right? Like, you get set up because it's federally funded and it is a standing military. Whereas at that time, there's nothing even remotely close to that because there's no established government. There's no taxes being collected. There's no infrastructure at the time. And so it is going to be left to the individual to say, you need to protect yourself, your family, and your community. And so therefore, you need to acquire your own equipment in order to do those things. And you're not fighting against, of course, the British military is going to be better armed and more armed because they do have the professionalism and the institutionalization of their military. But you're going to be like kind of musket against musket, bayonet against bayonet. Like, and we can talk about the implications for this in the 21st century, of course, because it's just so that the, there's a disparity between what citizens have and what the government has in terms of protection and in terms of weaponry. But at this time period, I mean, there's just, you're not lining up and being issued weapons. Like, you are responsible for that. And so, yes, everybody does need to have a gun. Everybody does need to have access to some form of protection because they're responsible for it. But it's all part of a quote, well-regulated militia, meaning that you bring your own equipment, but we're going to do this in as orderly of a fashion as possible.
Right. That this is it. So here's an interesting piece. So Alexander Hamilton, so he's a Federalist. So he's in support of the Constitution. Writes an essay called Concerning the Militia. And most of the people who sign the Constitution have a real issue with a standing army. They don't know whether this is actually a good idea or not. But and Hamilton says it will be possible to have an excellent body of well-trained militia ready to take the field whenever the defense of the state shall require it. This will not only lessen the call for military establishments, so that's standing army, but if circumstances should at any time oblige the government to form an army of any magnitude, that army can never be formidable to the liberties of the people while there's a large body of citizens, little, if at all, inferior to them in discipline and the use of arms, who stand ready to defend their own rights and those of their fellow citizens. This appears to me the only substitute that can be devised for a standing army and the best possible security against it, if it should exist. So again, you've got Hamilton who's backing this constitution, which is this centralized federal government that's going to have the explicit power to raise an army. And he's saying, look, a militia, a well-trained militia, is a safety mechanism.
I think with the Federalist versus Anti-Federalist argument, I mean, so much of it does stem back from that 17th century fear where they're trying to create this new government and they're trying to create a new society that veers away from what had been happening in Europe. And I think that so many people were afraid of all of the persecution that they had faced. And they had just this outright fear of government and of, militia or of, armies coming in or hurting them or torturing them, whatever, forcing conversion of religion. They experienced just this outright monarchy system that was very heavy-handed. And I think that they wanted to retreat from that. And I think they saw that, was going to just cause a huge problem.
So the federal government is a scary thing, right? The anti-federalists are terrified by it. And even the Federalists, even Hamilton's like, well, we kind of need a good militia just in case.
Well, and there's internal and external threats. I think,
right.
You mentioned that.
So we've got, So even after the Paris peace treaty, Britain still exists. Britain's not necessarily going to leave the United States alone.
Right.
You've and they still got the French, you still got the Spanish.
And still have a lot of indigenous people who, they're encroaching, the newly formed American government is encroaching still on native lands, and there's still a lot of fighting between new American citizens and native people. And there's all this spread into these regions, and there's uncertainty and instability. And so there's an argument certainly to be made that, like, look, we need to have this, quote, well-regulated militia to address all of these threats, both internal and external. But it's still met with a lot of trepidation, even by people who were supportive of it, just because they don't want to devolve into this system which they were trying to, like, fight against and get away from. And that makes sense to me.
Well, yeah. And I think, again, much like last week, I think we can look for a little clarification in those state constitutions that come around the Declaration of Independence, but well before kind of the Revolutionary War has been fought and resolved. Like the Virginia Declaration of Rights, Section 13, a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people trained to arms is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state. That standing armies in time of peace should be avoided as dangerous to liberty, and that in all cases the military should be under strict subordination to and governed by the civil power. So, I mean, it's interesting.
See, that's much clearer language.
Go ahead.
That language is much clearer to me, right? When you're looking at a state constitution. And to me, that goes more toward the first part of the statement of the amendment, of like the well-regulated militia part, not necessarily like every American should have a gun under their pillow. It's not really about that necessarily. It's about we as a community need to have collective security and be prepared and have this well-regulated, smaller, almost like a security force in place in order to address any sort of threat. And what's interesting, though, on all this research that I did in preparation for today, is there's all this language about, you know, you need to be able to fight against a tyrannical government. But there's never once been an actual support of the people doing that. And we talked really early on in an episode about the Whiskey Rebellion. I mean, we talked about that as this another moment of revolution, this other moment of chaotic revolution where things, you know, things weren't consolidated quite yet in the early Republic era. And you still had people kind of rebelling in these Western regions. And they were doing just that, right? They were taking up arms. They were trying to fight the consolidation of government and the consolidation of federal power. And they took up the arms that they had, right? And they were kind of working as militia to get tax collectors out of their region. But the government puts it down. So there's never actually a support for people to defend themselves. Never. I mean, it's written as it should be that way, and that people should be able to fight against the government. But when have people ever fought against the government and won?
Well, hold that thought 1 minute, because I want to get to it, but I want to continue with a couple of these state constitutions first, because I think it might help us a little bit, because this is the thing. So Virginia's is a little more clearly worded than when we get in the in the Bill of Rights. Pennsylvania's, the people have a right to bear arms for the defense of themselves and the state. I mean,
that's pretty clear.
That's pretty clear. And it says there are two reasons somebody has the right to bear arms: for the defense of themselves and the state. Maryland's talks about a militia being well-regulated, but it doesn't go as far as Pennsylvania's goes. North Carolina's, again, echoes that the people have a right to bear arms for the defense of the state. Which is interesting, right? Doesn't mention defense of themselves, defense of the state, and as standing armies in time of peace are dangerous to liberty, they ought not to be kept up, and that the military should be kept under strict subordination to and governed by the civil power. Which is interesting, we get that. New York talks about in its Constitution, talks about there are many Quakers in New York, and from scruples of conscience may be adverse to bearing of arms, be thereof excused by the legislature. So what does that mean? Well, New York says it is the duty of every man who enjoys the protection of society to be prepared and willing to defend it. That's, I mean, New York goes further than any of them, I think. New York is almost like you have to own a rifle.
Yeah, it's almost like mandatory military conscription in a way. But yeah, and see, Quakers like, wouldn't take up arms, but they made them. Quakers were notorious gun makers, right? They were the ones who made all the guns. So
right. But I mean, that's an interesting thing is that you know, you've got New York who's going even further. Vermont is almost the same language as Pennsylvania, right to bear arms for themselves and the state. And then Massachusetts. So a lot of times U.S. historians, we kind of point to Massachusetts and Virginia as kind of antipodes, right? They're kind of opposites in this relationship, that Massachusetts is Adams and the Puritans, whereas, you know, Virginia is Jamestown and Thomas Jefferson and kind of this rough and tumble place that's much more individualistic. But Massachusetts says the people have a right to keep and to bear arms for the common defense. And as in time of peace, armies are dangerous to liberty, they ought not to be maintained without the consent of the legislature. And the military power shall always be held in an exact subordination to the civil authority and be governed by it. So again, all of these states seem to be in agreement on a lot of things, although some of them go a little bit further in their language.
Yeah, and I think they're all in agreement for the first clause of that amendment, that collectively we should have some sort of community security force that's not a federal regulated standing army, but that there is some form of organized attempt to make sure that we can safeguard our community in a much smaller sense. And that makes so much sense when you look at the development of the United States and the different state governments and institutions that develop in the early republic. Many of them, even Federalists, do really want to kind of maintain that, you know, there's an individual responsibility that then translates to somewhat of a community responsibility, but trying to keep things more on the small scale. And these state constitutions, I think, really illustrate that nicely and actually have better language in some cases that clarify what it is that they mean by the right to keep and bear arms. But
right.
One thing that I kept going back and forth about whether or not to bring it up, but I'm going to bring it up. And I don't know, I want to talk through it a little bit because I don't know how to talk about it without sounding nuts. But let's keep in mind who this was written for. So when you're talking about citizens having a right to bear arms, who are citizens at this time?
It's white men.
It's white men, right? They have zero intention at this moment when this is written to extend these rights to every single person living in the United States. So they don't want women to be armed. They don't want slaves to be armed. They don't want free black people to be armed. They don't want indigenous people to be armed. They want to be armed. White men want to be armed. So that's just a very small percentage of people that these laws are being written for. And there's zero intention of incorporating everybody into that. And we see Supreme Court cases in the late 19th century that illustrate this fact so nicely, right? Is that the Klan was trying to stop black people from getting guns. And eventually the court's like, no, actually everybody gets to have the guns, right? But it's kind of a sticky, I think, it's kind of a sticky point to bring up because I'm not saying like, oh, only white men should have guns. Like that's absolutely not what I'm saying. But that was their intention when drafting this. And I think that it's very important to keep that in mind, particularly when we think about the 1960s and like say the Black Panthers who were saying, yeah, let's take up arms against the government. And everyone's like, whoa, 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 whoa. No, right?
Right.
And so it's important to kind of keep that framed, I think, of like, what was the intention and for whom was this intended?
Right. Well, So this gets embedded in the Bill of Rights, and we've already talked about how the Constitution is kind of a reaction to the things you brought up, right? The Constitution means things that happened in the Whiskey Rebellion, things that happened in Shays' Rebellion. Those can't be allowed to happen. And I think this gets to your question again of, well, why weren't those kind of viewed as legitimate uprisings against the government? And I think it's because you have to have a public sentiment that the government's doing something unjust. So Noah Webster has a good quote about this. He says, before a standing army can rule, the people must be disarmed, as they are in almost every kingdom in Europe. The supreme power in America cannot enforce unjust laws by the sword, because the whole body of the people are armed and constitute a force superior to any band of regular troops that can be on any pretense raised in the United States. So, I mean, Noah Webster is, you know, the well-armed militia is a guarantee that the government is not going to try to enact unjust laws. It's going to be a check on that power. And almost everybody who's kind of supporting this is saying something along the same vein, right? That the well-armed militia is going to keep unjust laws from actually getting created.
I think that's such an optimistic view, though, right? I mean, people want to think that, but it's just not the case.
And that's not what happens, right? I mean, that's not what happens in the 19th century.
No.
And I mean, the 19th century, we get a series of wars. The standing federal army becomes, you know, stays around and continues to stay around. It doesn't go away. But at the same time, it kind of gets normalized for people, right? They don't generally view the standing federal army as this oppressor in most places. Although when we get to kind of the 1860s, that changes substantially.
Well, certainly after the War of 1812, people do start to say, okay, there's a real value to this. I mean, the British come in and burn the Capitol down, right? So they're like, whoa,
right.
Maybe we need some protections that are more stable and formal. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, we get the Civil War, and after the Civil War, there's this first major Supreme Court case that involves the Second Amendment, and it's the U.S. versus Cruikshank. And it really is a question of, what does the Second Amendment allow me to do as a citizen? But they basically said the Bill of Rights restricts Congress. It doesn't apply to individuals. So the idea is that the Second Amendment can only restrict the powers of the national government. It doesn't guarantee the right of an individual to own a firearm. It's just the federal government can't take that right away.
That's such an important distinction, right?
Right. I mean, the court says the Second Amendment has no other effect than to restrict the powers of the national government. Their view is that local and state governments can do as they choose. Which is interesting, that this kind of gun debate, kind of in the modern context of it, goes back to this point, right? To kind of this Reconstruction era moment where guns are trying to be controlled. States are trying to control guns and people are challenging it. The Supreme Court's like, yeah, well, the Second Amendment doesn't mean what you think it means.
Well, and people are trying to control guns in the states because kind of what I mentioned earlier is that the Klan is very much involved in this case, right? They don't want black people to have guns. And so they're trying to restrict who can purchase guns, right? This is what this case is about in a way, isn't it? And it falls under like 14th Amendment protections, ultimately.
Right. So Then we get a series of other cases in the 19th century, Presser, Illinois, Miller, Texas, where it's this, you've got Presser and Miller both challenge and say that the states are infringing on their Second Amendment rights. And both times the courts say, well, nope, actually not, right? Illinois law, Texas law, the Second Amendment doesn't apply. The federal government can't make a law, but states can do what they want.
Yeah. And so what this ends up shaking out to, I mean, sometimes you might think, well, that's a good thing because, you know, the government's saying, well, no, we're not going to protect everybody to have a gun. But it ends up kind of being a bad thing, especially for African Americans in the South, because when you leave it up to the states, then, you know, only certain people are going to be able to have this right. And
right.
And I mean, it's such a, to me, it's such a muddy topic, right? Because in the 21st century, we're trying, you know, we're talking about like, well, we need to actually regulate guns and, you know, not everybody should have them. And this is not drawn on racial lines in any way. It's just like, you know, people shouldn't have these like certain kinds of weapons and for these reasons. But in the 19th century, it was kind of this like, It was a civil rights issue too. I mean, because it's like, well, if everybody's allowed to have a gun, then everybody's allowed to have a gun. That's it. You don't get to say who does and doesn't based on race. But then that ends up being what it shakes out to when they say, well, we'll just let the states decide. And it's like, every time you let the states decide, you can color a map and show which states are going to decide what. And it ends up disenfranchising Black people in those states. And so it ends up being muddy, right? Because in a way it's like, well, everybody should have more guns. But I think we're trying to fight against that now a little bit in the 21st century, even though the Supreme Court keeps voting to strengthen Second Amendment rights in the 21st century.
Kind of they do. But I mean, let's go to the case. District of Columbia versus Heller, 2008. I mean, this is the pivotal case for the Second Amendment.
And it strengthens the Second Amendment, I think.
It does, but if you read the majority opinion, I mean, so let's set the thing up. So Washington, D.C. instituted a weapons ban. And this was challenged, brought before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled you can't do that. You cannot impinge on an individual's right to own a gun. So they're actually saying the Second Amendment gives the individual a right to own a gun. But Antonin Scalia, in the majority opinion, says the following. So this is a very conservative menu of the Supreme Court, a member of the Supreme Court, says, like most rights, the right secured by the Second Amendment is not unlimited. Although we do not undertake an exhaustive historical analysis today of the full scope of the Second Amendment, nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, or laws forbidding the carry of firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings, or laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms. Go ahead.
That's interesting because in one way, I think it does strengthen the Second Amendment and rights to it. But in other ways, it starts to limit it by fleshing out special circumstances or scenarios, right? And then that's where we start, I think, kind of talking about mental health as related to gun ownership. That's a very 21st century discussion, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, Heller is kind of the opening battle in our contemporary battle over gun rights, right? What does the Second Amendment really do? If you're going on kind of legally what the Supreme Court has generally believed, prior to 2008, the court has time and time again said the Second Amendment really is only about the federal government prohibiting certain things. It's not about state and local governments. It's only till 2008 that we really get a clear moment where they're like, you know, actually, there is this right to own guns that's talked about in the Second Amendment. But even then, you've got strong qualifications on it. And I mean, the dissenting opinions are interesting. But I mean, we're still wrestling with the repercussions of Heller. So Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in an interview, said, when we no longer need people to keep muskets in their home, then the Second Amendment has no function. If the court had properly interpreted the Second Amendment, the court would have said that the amendment was very important when the nation was new. It gave a qualified right to keep and bear arms, but it was for one purpose only, and that was the purpose of having militiamen who were able to fight to preserve the nation. So this is Ruth Bader Ginsburg. This is her opinion. Now, this isn't an official opinion. This is a radio interview where she's talking about this. But she has long said the Heller decision is one of the court's worst decisions, that she was kind of sitting on the court when it was made. What do you think?
Well, I think that she's doing her job appropriately because she's interpreting it. I mean, this is...
You don't think she's a little wrong?
No, I don't. I really don't. And I'm not someone who's like, oh, we need to go take everyone's guns away. Like, honestly, I kind of fall on the side of like, I don't really have a passionate opinion about it, to be honest, because I grew up in a house that had guns in it. My parents were police officers. Like, I'm very used to guns being around. But I think when you look at the amendment, the context of the amendment, why it was written, I think that she's absolutely spot on. Like, you had to have a musket in your house to protect your family and to be, if called to service for the country, you would have your own equipment. That's not the case anymore. We have a standing army now. You report to the military, they give you the stuff that you need, right?
What about individual protection?
I think it's more dangerous to have a gun. I really do. I mean, my dad always said I'm not allowed to have a gun because someone would take it from me and shoot me with it. And I think he's absolutely right. I mean, I think there are so many deaths related to like accidental gun discharge, all that kind of stuff, where like, if you value human life and value each life as precious, even one accidental discharge of a gun in somebody's household is too much. To me.
Right.
And I, again, I'm not someone who's like, oh, let's go take everyone's guns away. You know, have as many guns as you want, whatever. But I think her interpretation of it is absolutely spot on. Because if you're looking at the context historically, it's like they had it for a reason. I mean, the document was written in a specific context. They never anticipated the 21st century context of having a gun.
Well, but I mean, isn't it fair to say that since those state constitutions are kind of antecedents of the Bill of Rights, and we've kind of shown how especially the Virginia Declaration of Rights, but the other state constitutions as well, kind of form what we end up with for the Bill of Rights. And those are kind of saying, not just for the defense of the nation, but for the defense of the individual. And Ginsburg just kind of ignores that. So she focuses on a thing that I think, yes, you could say, you know, you're not going to take your rifle and defend against an invading army, although you could maybe make an argument for that. But she leaves out the self-preservation part of it completely. She leaves out defense of the individual. Granted, that's not explicitly mentioned in the Second Amendment, the way it finds its way into the Constitution. But, you know...
And so that's what she's supposed to be interpreting. She's not supposed to be interpreting state government's constitutions about what it says. She is a federal, right? She's on the Supreme Court. She is interpreting the Second Amendment. And I will be honest, it's clearly in the second part of the Second Amendment after the comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It's black and white. There's no... In a linguistic sense, there's no two ways about it. That's what it says. You should have a gun if you want a gun, right? But in my opinion, I think that things have to shift based upon context. And I mean, I think in the context that this was written, it made perfect sense. In a 21st century context, I think it's a lot hazier. And there have been things over the course of, you know, our country's history that we have changed on multiple accounts, right? We have lots of different amendments to address context and to address a moment. to fix something that was maybe, okay, well, you know, we need to address something that was not addressed. And it, this is just one of those things, in my opinion, where it's just like, you know, I think that we need to kind of revisit this because it's not about having a well-regulated militia. And I think what it goes back to for me, and you said to hold the thought, but maybe it's time now, it's just, what are you going to do with a gun against, say, a tyrannical government? Right. And I know you're talking about individual protection and like maybe if somebody was invading my home, I wish I did have a gun. I don't know. I don't, right? But I guess there's two different things at play here, right? It's like the protection of the individual, but then also protection against a tyrannical government. They're two separate issues, though they're conflated into one amendment in a bad, poorly written sentence.
So I want to bring up one last case. It's a case where the arguments were just heard today. New York State Rifle and Pistol Association. We're recording on December 2nd. New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus City of New York. And the issue, and this is a great website. I have to kind of talk about this. If you really want to keep, if you love the Supreme Court talking about stuff, you should go to this. It's the SCOTUSblog.com, SCOTUSblog.com. The issue is whether New York City's ban on transporting a licensed, locked, and unloaded handgun to a home or shooting range outside city limits is consistent with the Second Amendment, the Commerce Clause, and the constitutional right to travel. It's an interesting thing. So New York City, much like Washington, D.C., is doing something that may test the limits of the Second Amendment. Now, the interesting thing is they muddy it with the Commerce Clause and the constitutional right to travel, which you always – an interesting thing is the Supreme Court will oftentimes take the path of least resistance. So they'll rule on something that makes it easy for them to make a ruling but not have to rule on something that might be a little more controversial. So they could just say New York's violating the Commerce Clause or the right to travel. And leave the other issue kind of alone, or they could kind of take them all on. But I got the transcript earlier today. I have not had a chance to go through it because it is 81 pages long. But it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Well, weren't they trying to drop the whole thing, though, because the law had been dropped in New York State? And so they said, like, we're not even going to attempt to go over this because it's already been dropped as an issue within the state.
Well, it says here, let's check. So in September, it was set for argument. No, the transcript, it happened today. So they wanted to dismiss it, but I guess they didn't because they did hear arguments on it today. I mean, there was definitely a transcript issue today.
Yeah, I know they heard it today and I was reading about it, but I think that one of the things was is they were like, look, this has already been dropped within the state, so it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense for us to hash this out.
So the even court could actually come back.
Hear it. Yeah.
Right. So their opinion could simply be this has been dropped.
I think that's what it ends up hashing out to, but we would have to go over the transcript. But it's super timely, right? That it's like we're talking about this and today there is still an argument over, and there will continue to be arguments over what the Second Amendment means or doesn't mean.
Right.
So
well, I mean, they're talking about safely transporting guns. Alito mentions the Second Amendment. Would it be consistent with the Second Amendment for the city to prohibit any trip by a person holding a premises license to a firing range? I mean, they're definitely talking about some of the issues. It'll be interesting. I can't say that I can't wait to read the transcript, but I look forward to perusing it and seeing if there's anything interesting that got mentioned. But I mean, this is a contentious issue. And you know, this book comes out. Now we want to switch gears a little bit. This book comes out in 2001. Do you know what day it came out in 2001? Just guess.
September 11th.
September 11th, 2001. It's called Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture. And it's a professor at Emory University, Michael Belisle. There's multiple pronunciations of his name. I've yet to find kind of a definitive explanation of how to pronounce it. But in it, Belisle makes an argument that gun culture, as kind of it's presented by the NRA and other organizations, is a relatively recent thing. That if you go back to colonial America, if you go back to the early republic, if you go back to the first half of the 19th century, gun culture isn't so much a thing. And what he interestingly does is he uses these probate records to show that guns just aren't appearing in people's belongings after they're dead. And he makes this argument that that's evidence that they just aren't widely held, that a lot of people don't own guns. And this comes out, and it's really shocking to people. Well, and Gary Wills in the New York Times, do what?
People were pumped about it.
I guess it came out in 2000. I guess the paperback came out in 2001. The hardback came out in 2000. I'm corrected. Well, so Gary Wills in the New York Times writes about it, and this is when the book came out. Belisle has dispersed the darkness that covered the gun's early history in America. He provides overwhelming evidence that our view of the gun is as deep a superstition as any that affected Native Americans in the 17th century. Congrats, Gary, on being racist in that sentence.
Yeah, he really did it, didn't he?
It's like, congratulations for going, being gung-ho, pun intended, for Belisle, but also being racist against indigenous people at the same moment. Congratulations, mm-hmm. Gary. A lot of people initially jump on this. They're like, yes, you know, here's an historian saying something we want to say, which is like, this is a recent thing. But almost
immediately, it wins a Bancroft Prize.
It wins the highest award you can get for a book in U.S. history.
Because faculty jumped all over this book like, yes, we finally can fight against the NRA. We can show, you know, that, you know, this is a recent conception and all this kind of stuff. And everybody just jumps to it because, unfortunately, history is often political. And this is such a sad, sad example of how that plays out in a really negative way for the historical community, right? Because then what ends up happening after the Bancroft is won and everybody's just so pumped about it, what ends up happening?
Right. Well, pretty soon after the book comes out, some people start to wonder about what's going on. Now, some of those people actually get funding from the NRA to investigate the book. And the NRA obviously doesn't like this book. And that's another conversation. I mean, here's the thing. If something's fundamentally wrong and somebody you disagree with points out that it's wrong, does that make what they pointed out not true? No, right? But the NRA doesn't like this book. Some people start to investigate it, and you get this kind of famous book review that gets written that kind of sums all this up. You've got a Stanford professor of law, James Lindgren. You've got some other historians and researchers and kind of legal historians and legal scholars who start to look at this, and people start to ask questions about the sources Belisle used. Because one of the things we're supposed to do is when we write something, we're supposed to document the sources we're using so that somebody else can come in and actually, if they wanted to, go back and track all those sources down, right?
Right. Yeah. And that's not the case in this situation.
Well, so what happens is people start to have trouble, like finding some of the sources Belisle talks about.
Doesn't he say that, like, oh, there was a fire?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so he claims that there was a fire. And then the heat, you know, pun intended, starts to come up again. You know, people are like, huh, that sounds kind of odd. So 2000, the book comes out. By 2002, there's this brewing scandal. And then July of 2002, Emory University, that's where Belial is a professor at the time, launches an investigation. And these are the things they want to investigate. And I just want to read this closely. I mean, the list is interesting. Question one, did Professor Belial engage in intentional fabrication or falsification of research data in connection with probate records from Rutland County, Vermont? Question two, same, but for Providence, Rhode Island. Question three, the same, but for San Francisco Bay Area. Question four, did Professor Belial engage in intentional fabrication or falsification of research data in connection with probate records supporting the figures in Table 1 to his book, Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture? And question five, did Professor Belial engage in other serious deviations from accepted practices in carrying out or reporting results from research with respect to probate records and militia consensus records by A, failing to carefully document his findings, B, failing to make available to others his sources, evidence, and data, or C, misrepresenting evidence of their sources of data? And they cite the American Historical Association's statement of standards in this, and it's kind of this pretty dry academic 40-page investigation. But the committee says he did. Like, he did all of these things, right? He did not do what he was supposed to do. And it didn't help Belial that when he was interviewed, he was evasive about his sources and things. I mean, is it because he knows the gig's up?
Yeah, I mean, he ends up resigning as a result of it. I think he absolutely knows. And so to clarify really quickly for our listeners, he said that there was a flood, not a fire. I apologize.
Oh, a flood.
It was a flood.
Yes, flood.
But I think, of course, he knows that. You know, the Bancroft Prize is rescinded in 2002. The jig is up, right? I mean, I think he absolutely knows that. And in order to save some face, I mean, because it's tough to get fired as a professor, but I mean, I think that was just the writing was on the wall there. And so I think he had no other choice but to just kind of back out gracefully as possible.
So, I mean, he loses his position as a professor at Emory. So he loses tenure. He loses the Bancroft. He still to this day contends he did nothing wrong, though.
Well, I mean, right. You know, yeah. I think we probably would have to try to.
Well, and he has actually, a few years ago, 2012, he came out with a new book, 1877.
Yeah, I don't think anybody bought it.
You should go and read the reviews. They're kind of, a lot of people don't seem to be aware who he is.
Oh, okay.
But then every once in a while, one of the reviews is, they're like, great fiction. And this is the problem, right? So once you do this, nobody's ever going to believe you again.
Well, and the words that came out about him in reaction to discovering this fraud. I mean, so one of the things I would like to point out is people were too quick to jump on this argument that seems to come out of the clear blue sky, that in your heart, you know, to be untrue. If you've studied American history, if you know anything about American history, if you know anything about the American Republic, early American Republic, I would be so skeptical of this book. I would like to point out I was very young when it came out, so I couldn't have joined the conversation, but I would have been so skeptical of that. Yet they were so quick to jump on it because it served a political purpose. And I just want to be clear about that. I mean, I think that was the downfall of this situation is like people were so keen to say, look, we have proof to prove a political point. And that that really clouds judgment because just at the basis of it, it made no sense. And once people started looking into it, Roger Lane, who had initially reviewed the book positively in the biggest journal in our field, Journal of American History, he ends up coming out in the wake of this, and he has some really strong words saying that he's betrayed us, he's a disgrace to the profession, he's breached our trust. And how do you recover from that as a faculty member? I mean, you just can't. You have the biggest journal in the field saying this guy is a total fraud. And I mean, people were using the word fraud to describe him. I mean, it's tough to recover from that. But again, I want to point out, like, well, you guys got duped and you should have known better. I mean, maybe it's like hindsight's 2020, but it's like you didn't read that and go, wait a minute, you know?
Well, so this is the thing. I think this is the issue when you write a history that has an overt political end, that you start researching a topic and you have the destination you want to get to.
That's called cherry picking the archive, for the record.
Exactly.
Cherry picking the archive.
And we know people who do this, right? I mean, people do this.
I won't name any names.
Well, there's a book that I think there's a lot of good in the book. But I did some research because I wanted to know a little bit more about things covered in the book. And when I went to the archives that the historian referenced, it turns out the historian had really cherry-picked some stuff because it would say one thing in the monograph. But when I turned the page in the sources, it would undermine what was being argued in the monograph. And it was like, I'm glad you looked at page 12, but you should have looked at page 13. And taking that into account as well, because I don't think your point would be as strong. And, you know, it's in today's culture, there's already a trust issue between academics and the public. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, gosh, absolutely. Yeah. And then you get cases like this, and it seems to just illustrate people's distrust. And I think it's a broader distrust of institutions, to be honest. But most certainly between academia and the public, there's a mistrust. And then you have, something arise like this, and it just kind of points out. And I mean, I guess we're not doing a service either to say we know people who do this. But I mean,
we are calling people out on it as well, right? I mean, there is this kind of historians who, you know, say things and then they get kind of taken to task, whether it's in somebody else's book or whether it's kind of in this thing that Lindgren did, where it's an article where he kind of talks about this and says, this isn't really true. I mean, the Academy can fix this. There is a mechanism in the Academy to fix this.
It's called peer review, but it doesn't always work.
I know.
Yeah. And that's the whole thing, right? I mean, this was one of those instances where it's like, this guy won the highest prize in the field for it because it went through peer review, and yet nobody raised a red flag because they were just all too happy with a narrative that they liked. And this goes to what I talk about in my teaching style too, is like, I don't go in with an agenda. I think that that's dishonest. I really do try to flesh out the complexity of every situation because you can argue something either way. You know, I could have taken the exact opposite stance on the Second Amendment today and come in and said, I have, you know, 19 guns and I want 23 more and I should have that, right? Like, you can make that argument. And I know people who do, and I know people who are passionate about it. And I think that there's plenty of evidence to back up their claim. And that's the whole point about history, is to flesh out the complexity of something. So what you're mentioning about, you know, you read page 12, but you didn't read page 13, that's so important because when historians go that extra mile to say, look, this is actually really complicated. I want to argue these things and I have this evidence, but look, there's also this, because the Second Amendment itself does that. It kind of contradicts itself within the same sentence. Right. And that's just happens throughout history. And it's important to point that out.
Well, and as we've talked about with the Second Amendment, you can cherry pick the evidence for what the Second Amendment may or may not mean and present very different versions.
Compelling on both sides. I think both sides can be really compelling evidence.
Right.
It comes down to a personal, your own personal belief on it.
Right. I mean, that's the, once you bring it all together, it's a lot more complex. And, you know, here's the thing is, I think, so Belial sets back any serious history of gun ownership in the United States 20 years. Because now anybody writing after him, it's going to seem they're either trying to just restate what he stated, or it's a complete repudiation of and not giving any possibility to maybe the maybe gun culture wasn't as big as we imagined or something. But it's, I mean, he contaminated that field for some time. And this is, you know, again, this is the problem with this kind of, what do we call it? Like activist history?
Yeah, activist history, or just, I mean, I don't know if there's a label for it, but just having a political agenda when you're going to work to try to flesh out something that happened or the impact something that happened. And you know what? I think you could have a really spirited discussion with somebody who goes into the classroom with an agenda, who does write with an agenda. And I think that they could defend their stance. And I respect a lot of people who do that, because I think that some of those people do good work, even though they do have a political agenda, because sometimes there is evidence to completely support their agenda. Right. But that's just not where I come from. Like, I really don't think it's my job. I mean, I wouldn't, because, you know, think about journalism and journalistic standards. Like, that's the first thing you learn in journalism is, like, you're really supposed to try not to be biased. And I consider myself a journalist of the past. And so I just try to go into the archive, and this takes a long time. When you don't go in with an agenda, it takes years to do a project. Oh, if you go in with an agenda, you can just pick out whatever you want and say, okay, there's my argument. But if you go in honestly with a clear mind and an open mind, it takes years to flesh out the complexity of an event in history and its impact, because you're going in there trying to learn what happened, and you end up reading everything. It takes a long, long time to really get a project going. So that's just my stance on it. Like, that's my approach, is like, I really try not to go in with an idea of what I want to come out with, because that's dishonest. I don't know. I think it's dishonest.
Oh, I think it's dishonest too. I mean, it's, we've talked about this before, kind of privately, not in the podcast, but it's like, your research should organically lead to an argument, not, you can't force it. And it's one of the things that's interesting to do also, is you've got all this evidence, and you kind of look at it, and you think, okay, well, what, you know, what does this mean? If I look at all this evidence, are there any conclusions I can draw? Is there anything I can, like, say that I have, like, the critical mass of evidence to support that statement? And that's what we try to teach our students, is this is how you should approach the study of history. But I mean, Belial, I think, joins this kind of list of people who really, really harm the academy in fundamental ways.
Yeah, most certainly harms the reputation that's already fragile. And I mean, I think that for me, the reason that I like doing this podcast is because it gives us a way to maybe in small ways heal that distrust, right? Because I'm hoping that people who aren't in the field, and I would assume most people who listen to this aren't actually in the field of history, and I hope that this kind of serves to bridge that gap of trust, because it was very much violated in the case of this book. And, you know, the name of the book is Arming America. But it's just, I think it's important to, like you said, to call it out and to discuss it honestly, and especially with such a contentious issue, because everyone can, you can have a political stance, but you kind of have to leave it at the door when you go to work, I think.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Well said. On that note, let's end it. This is a long episode.
Oh, goodness.
It was fun, though. I love talking about this with you.
Yeah. And we'll, you know, I don't think that we'll do, are we going to do all the amendments right in a row? Or are we going
to
do
something? Not right in a row. Well, it'll be a little break before we come back to the amendments. These first two have taken a lot out of us. We want to get back to a little bit lighter fare.
Yeah.
We've got some listener requests in that we're going to kind of sort through and figure out what we want to do with. I have to talk Hillary into a Christmas episode.
I can be talked into a Christmas episode.
You can be talked into it. Sure. Can I have a soundboard loaded up with Christmas sounds?
No, that you can't do. But we can just do Christmas.
Like jingle bells?
Oh, God. Maybe in the beginning. Like instead of the little music.
Yeah, I could do jingle bells.
You can do jingle bells. Yeah.
Awesome.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Sure.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you for joining us. Tune in next time to An Incomplete History. I hope you kind of learned some stuff today, maybe had some information that made you think twice maybe about your own political views about the Second Amendment. Make sure you tune in next week on An Incomplete History. I'm Jeff.
And I'm Hillary.
Until next time.